Side 6, Hit by Stephen King. Continuing on page 192. During periods of heavy rain, they were all apt to overflow their banks. If it rains 2 weeks, the whole damn town gets a sinus infection, Stuttering Bill's dad had said once. The Kanduskeag was caged in a concrete canal 2 miles long as it passed through downtown. This canal dived under Main Street at the intersection of Main and Canal, becoming an underground river for half a mile or so before surfacing again at Basie Park. Canal Street, where most of Derry's bars were ranked like felons in a police lineup, paralleled the canal on its way out of town, and every few weeks or so the police would have to fish some drunk's car out of the water, which was polluted to drop-dead levels by sewage and mill wastes. Fish were caught from time to time in the canal, but they were inedible mutants. On the northeastern side of town, the canal side, the river had been managed to at least some degree. A thriving commerce went on all along it in spite of the occasional flooding. People walked beside the canal, sometimes hand in hand. If the wind was right, that was. If it was wrong, the stench took much of the romance out of such strolling. And at Basie Park, which faced the high school across the canal, there were sometimes Boy Scout campouts and Cub Scout wiener roasts. In 1969, the citizens would be shocked and sickened to discover that hippies, one of them had actually sewed an American flag on the seat of his pants, and that pinko faggot was busted before you could say Gene McCarthy, were smoking dope and trading pills up there. By 69, Basie Park had become a regular open-air pharmacy. "You just wait," people said. "Somebody'll get killed before they put a stop to it." And, of course, someone finally did. A 17-year-old boy had been found dead by the canal, his veins full of almost pure heroin, what the kids called a tight white rail. After that, the druggies began to drift away from Basie Park, and there were even stories that the kid's ghost was haunting the area. The story was stupid, of course, but if it kept the speed freaks and the nodders away, it was at least a useful, stupid story. On the southwestern side of town, the river presented even more of a problem. Here the hills had been deeply cut open by the passing of the Great Glacier, and further wounded by the endless water erosion of the Kanduskeag and its webwork of tributaries. The bedrock showed through in many places like the half-unearthed bones of dinosaurs. Veteran employees of the Derry Public Works Department knew that, following the fall's first hard frost, they could count on a good deal of sidewalk repair on the southwestern side of town. The concrete would contract and grow brittle, and then the bedrock would suddenly shatter up through it, as if the earth meant to hatch something. What grew best in the shallow soil which remained was plants with shallow root systems and hardy natures. Weeds and trash plants, in other words. Scruffy trees, thick low bushes, and virulent infestations of poison ivy and poison oak grew everywhere they were allowed a foothold. The southwest was where the land fell away steeply to the area that was known in Derry as the Barrens. The Barrens, which were anything but barren, were a messy tract of land about 1.5 miles wide by 3 miles long. It was bounded by Upper Kansas Street on one side, and by Old Cape on the other. Old Cape was a low-income housing development, and the drainage was so bad over there that there were stories of toilets and sewer pipes actually exploding. The Kanduskeag ran through the center of the Barrens. The city had grown up to the northeast and on both sides of it, but the only vestiges of the city down there were Derry Pump House No. 3, the municipal sewage pumping station, and the city dump. Seen from the air, the Barrens looked like a big green dagger pointing at downtown. To Ben, all this geography mated with geology meant was a vague awareness that there were no more houses on his right side now. The land had dropped away. A rickety whitewashed railing, about waist high, ran beside the sidewalk, a token gesture of protection. He could faintly hear running water. It was the soundtrack to his continuing fantasy. He paused and looked out over the Barrens, still imagining her eyes, the clean smell of her hair. From here, the Kanduskeag was only a series of twinkles seen through breaks in the thick foliage. Some kids said that there were mosquitoes as big as sparrows down there at this time of the year. Others said there was quicksand as you approached the river. Ben didn't believe it about the mosquitoes, but the idea of quicksand scared him. Slightly to his left, he could see a cloud of circling, diving seagulls. The dump. Their cries reached him faintly. Across the way, he could see Derry Heights and the low roofs of the old Cape houses closest to the Barrens. To the right of Old Cape, pointing skyward like a squat white finger, was the Derry standpipe. Directly below him, a rusty culvert stuck out of the earth, spilling discolored water down the hill in a glimmering little stream which disappeared into the tangled trees and bushes. Ben's pleasant fantasy of Beverly was suddenly broken by one far more grim. What if a dead hand flopped out of that culvert right now, right this second, while he was looking? And suppose that when he turned to find a phone and call the police, a clown was standing there. A funny clown wearing a baggy suit with big orange puffs for buttons. Suppose... A hand fell on Ben's shoulder and he screamed. There was laughter. He whirled around, shrinking against the white fence separating the safe, sane sidewalk of Kansas Street from the wildly undisciplined Barrens. The railing creaked audibly, and saw Henry Bowers, Belch Huggins, and Victor Criss standing there.
"Hi, tits," Henry said.
"What do you want?"
Ben asked, trying to sound brave.
"I want to beat you up," Henry said.
He seemed to contemplate this prospect soberly, even gravely. But, oh, his black eyes sparkled.
"I got to teach you something, tits. You won't mind. You like to learn new things, don't you?"
He reached for Ben. Ben ducked away.
"Hold him, you guys!"
Belch and Victor seized his arms. Ben squealed. It was a cowardly sound, rabbity and weak, but he couldn't help it.
"Please, God, don't let them make me cry, and don't let them break my watch," Ben thought wildly.
He didn't know if they would get around to breaking his watch or not, but he was pretty sure he would cry. He was pretty sure he would cry plenty before they were through with him.
"Cheese him. He sounds just like a pig," Victor said.
He twisted Ben's wrist. "Don't he sound like a pig?"
"He sure do," Belch giggled.
Ben lunged first one way and then the other. Belch and Victor went with him easily, letting him lunge, then yanking him back. Henry grabbed the front of Ben's sweatshirt and yanked it upward, exposing his belly. It hung over his belt in a swollen droop.
"Look at that gut," Henry cried in amazed disgust. "Jesus, please us."
Victor and Belch laughed some more. Ben looked around wildly for help. He could see no one. Behind him, down on the Barrens, crickets drowsed and seagulls screamed.
"You just better quit," he said.
He wasn't blubbering yet, but he was close to it.
"You just better." "Or what?"
Henry asked, as if he was honestly interested.
"Or what, tits? Or what, huh?"
Ben suddenly found himself thinking of Broderick Crawford, who played Dan Matthews on Highway Patrol. That bastard was tough. That bastard was mean. That bastard took zero shit from anybody. And then he burst into tears. Dan Matthews would have belted these guys right through the fence, down the embankment, and into the pucker brush. He would have done it with his belly.
"Oh, boy, look at the baby,"
Victor chortled. Belch joined in. Henry smiled a little, but his face still held that grave, reflective cast, that look that was somehow almost sad. It frightened Ben. It suggested he might be in for more than just a beating. As if to confirm this idea, Henry reached into his jeans pocket and brought out a buck knife. Ben's terror exploded. He had been whipsawing his body futilely to either side. Now he suddenly lunged straight forward. There was an instant when he believed he was going to get away. He was sweating heavily, and the boys holding his arms had greasy grips at best. Belch managed to hold on to his right wrist, but just barely. He pulled entirely free of Victor. Another lunge. Before he could make it, Henry stepped forward and gave him a shove. Ben flew backward. The railing creaked more loudly this time, and he felt it give a little under his weight. Belch and Victor grabbed him again.
"Now you hold him," Henry said. "You hear me?" "Sure, Henry," Belch said.
He sounded a trifle uneasy. "He ain't gonna get away. Don't worry." Henry stepped forward until his flat stomach almost touched Ben's belly. Ben stared at him, tears spilling helplessly out of his wide eyes.
"Caught! I'm caught!"
a part of his mind yammered. He tried to stop it. He couldn't think at all with that yammering going on. But it wouldn't stop. "Caught! Caught! Caught!" Henry pulled out the blade, which was long and wide and engraved with his name. The tip glittered in the afternoon sunshine.
"I'm going to test you now," Henry said in that same reflective voice. "It's exam time, Tits, and you better be ready."
Ben wept. His heart thundered madly in his chest. Snot ran out of his nose and collected on his upper lip. His library books lay in a scatter at his feet. Henry stepped on Bulldozer, glanced down, and dealt it into the gutter with a side swipe of one black engineer boot.
"Here's the first question on your exam, Tits. When somebody says, 'Let me copy during finals,' what are you going to say?"
"Yes," Ben exclaimed immediately. "I'm going to say yes, sure, okay, copy all you want."
The buck's tip slid through 2 inches of air and pressed against Ben's stomach. It was as cold as an ice cube tray just out of the frigid air. Ben gasped his belly away from it. For a moment, the world went gray. Henry's mouth was moving, but Ben couldn't tell what he was saying. Henry was like a TV with the sound turned off, and the world was swimming, swimming.
"Don't you dare faint," the panicky voice shrieked. "If you faint, he may get mad enough to kill you."
The world came back into some kind of focus. He saw that both Belch and Victor had stopped laughing. They looked nervous, almost scared. Seeing that had the effect of a head-clearing slap on Ben.
All of a sudden, they don't know what he's going to do, or how far he might go. However bad you thought things were, that's how bad they really are, maybe even a little worse. You've got to think. If you never did before or never do again, you better think now, because his eyes say they're right to look nervous. His eyes say he's crazy as a bedbug.
"That's the wrong answer, Tits," Henry said. "If just anyone says, 'Let me copy,' I don't give a red fuck what you do. Got it?"
"Yes," Ben said, his belly hitching with sobs. "Yes, I got it."
"Well, okay. That's one wrong, but the biggies are still coming up. You ready for the biggies?"
I guess so."
A car came slowly toward them. It was a dusty 51 Ford with an old man and woman propped up in the front seat like a pair of neglected department store mannequins. Ben saw the old man's head turn slowly toward him. Henry stepped closer to Ben, hiding the knife. Ben could feel its point dimpling his flesh just above his belly button. It was still cold. He didn't see how that could be, but it was.
"Go ahead, yell," Henry said. "You'll be picking your fucking guts off your sneakers."
They were close enough to kiss. Ben could smell the sweet smell of juicy fruit gum on Henry's breath. The car passed and continued on down Kansas Street, as slow and serene as the pace car in the Tournament of Roses parade.
"All right, Tits, here's the second question. If I say, 'Let me copy,' during finals, what are you going to say?"
"Yes, I'll say yes right away."
Henry smiled.
"That's good. You got that one right, Tits. Now here's the third question. How am I going to be sure you never forget that?"
I don't know," Ben whispered.
Henry smiled. His face lit up and was for a moment almost handsome.
"I know," he said, as if he had discovered a great truth. "I know, Tits. I'll carve my name on your big fat gut."
Victor and Belch abruptly began laughing again. For a moment, Ben felt a species of bewildered relief, thinking it had all been nothing but make-believe. A little shuck and jive the three of them had whomped up to scare the living hell out of him. But Henry Bowers wasn't laughing, and Ben suddenly understood that Victor and Belch were laughing because they were relieved. It was obvious to both of them that Henry couldn't be serious.
Except Henry was.
The buck knife slid upward, smooth as butter. Blood welled in a bright red line on Ben's pallid skin.
"Hey!"
Victor cried. The word came out, muffled in a startled gulp.
"Hold him!" Henry snarled. "You just hold him, hear me?"
Now there was nothing grave and reflective on Henry's face. Now it was the twisted face of a devil.
"Cheese him crow, Henry, don't really cut him!"
Belch screamed, and his voice was high, almost a girl's voice. Everything happened fast then, but to Ben Hanscom it all seemed slow. It all seemed to happen in a series of shutter clicks, like action stills in a Life magazine photo essay. His panic was gone. He had discovered something inside him suddenly, and because it had no use for panic, that something just ate the panic whole. In the first shutter click, Henry had snatched his sweatshirt all the way up to his nipples. Blood was pouring from the shallow vertical cut above his belly button.
In the second shutter click, Henry drew the knife down again, operating fast like a lunatic battle surgeon under an aerial bombardment. Fresh blood flowed. Backward, Ben thought coldly as blood flowed down in pool between the waistband of his jeans and his skin. Got to go backward. That's the only direction I can get away in. Belch and Victor weren't holding him anymore. In spite of Henry's command, they had drawn away. They had drawn away in horror. But if he ran, Bowers would catch him. In the third shutter click, Henry connected the two vertical slashes with a short horizontal line. Ben could feel blood running into his underpants now, and a sticky snail trail was creeping down his left thigh. Henry leaned back momentarily, frowning with the studied concentration of an artist painting a landscape. After H comes E, Ben thought. And that was all it took to get him moving. He pulled forward a little bit, and Henry shoved him back again. Ben pushed with his legs, adding his own force to Henry's. He hit the whitewashed railing between Kansas Street and the drop into the Barrens. As he did, he raised his right foot and planted it in Henry's belly. This was not a retaliatory act. Ben only wanted to increase his backward force. And yet when he saw the expression of utter surprise on Henry's face, he was filled with a clear, savage joy. A feeling so intense that for a split second he thought the top of his head was going to come off. Then there was a cracking, splintering sound from the railing. Ben saw Victor and Belch catch Henry before he could fall on his ass in the gutter next to the remains of Bulldozer, and then Ben was falling backward into space. He went with a scream that was half a laugh. Ben hit the slope on his back and buttocks just below the culvert he had spotted earlier. It was a good thing he landed below it. If he had landed on it, he might well have broken his back. As it was, he landed on a thick cushion of weeds and bracken and barely felt the impact. He did a backward somersault, feet and legs snapping over his head. He landed sitting up and went sliding down the slope backward like a kid on a big green shoot-the-shoot. His sweatshirt pulled up around his neck, his hands grabbing for purchase and doing nothing but yanking out tuft after tuft of bracken and witchgrass. He saw the top of the embankment. It seemed impossible that he had just been standing up there, receding with crazy cartoon speed. He saw Victor and Belch, their faces round white O's, staring down at him. He had time to mourn his library books. Then he fetched up against something with agonizing force and nearly bit his tongue in half. It was a downed tree, and it checked Ben's fall by nearly breaking his left leg. He clawed his way back up the slope a little bit, pulling his leg free with a groan. The tree had stopped him about halfway down. Below, the bushes were thicker. Water falling from the culvert ran over his hands in thin streams. There was a shriek from above him. Ben looked up again and saw Henry Bowers come flying over the drop, his knife clenched between his teeth. He landed on both feet, body thrown backward at a steep angle so he would not overbalance. He skidded to the end of a gigantic set of footprints and then began to run down the embankment at a series of gangling kangaroo leaps.
"I'm going to kill it's."
Henry was shrieking around the knife, and Ben didn't need a UN translator to tell him Henry was saying, "I'm going to kill you tits."
"I'm going to hucking kill you."
Now, with that cold general's eye he had discovered up above on the sidewalk, Ben saw what he had to do. He managed to gain his feet just before Henry arrived, the knife now in his hand and held straight out in front of him like a bayonet. Ben was peripherally aware that the left leg of his jeans was shredded, and his leg was bleeding much more heavily than his stomach, but it was supporting him, and that meant it wasn't broken. At least he hoped that's what it meant. Ben crouched slightly to maintain his precarious balance, and as Henry grabbed at him with one hand and swept the knife in a long, flat arc with the other, Ben stepped aside. He lost his balance, but as he fell down, he stuck out his shredded left leg. Henry's shin struck it, and his legs were booted out from under him with great efficiency. For a moment, Ben gaped, his terror overcome with a mixture of awe and admiration. Henry Bowers appeared to be flying exactly like Superman over the fallen tree where Ben had stopped. His arms were straight out in front of him, the way George Reeves held his arms out on the TV show. Only George Reeves always looked like flying was as natural as taking a bath or eating lunch on the back porch. Henry looked like someone had shoved a hot poker up his ass. His mouth was opening and closing. A string of saliva was shooting back from one corner of it, and as Ben watched, it splattered against the lobe of Henry's ear. Then Henry crashed back to earth. The knife flew out of his hand. He rolled over on one shoulder, landed on his back, and slid away into the bushes with his legs splayed into a V. There was a yell, a thud, and then silence. Ben sat, dazed, looking at the matted place in the bushes where Henry had done his disappearing act. Suddenly, rocks and pebbles began to bounce by him. He looked up again. Victor and Belch were now descending the embankment. They were moving more carefully than Henry, and hence more slowly, but they would reach him in 30 seconds or less if he didn't do something. He moaned, would this lunacy never end? Keeping his eye on them, he clambered over the downed tree and began to scramble down the embankment, panting harshly. He had a stitch in his side. His tongue hurt like hell. The bushes were now almost as tall as Ben himself. The randy green smell of stuff growing out of control filled his nose. He could hear running water somewhere close, chuckling over stones and rilling between them. His feet slipped, and here he went again, rolling and sliding, smashing the back of his hand against a jutting rock, shooting through a patch of thorns that hooked blue-gray puffs of cotton from his sweatshirt and little divots of meat from his hands and cheeks. He slammed to a jarring halt, sitting up, with his feet in the water. Here was a little curving stream which wound its way into a thick stand of second-growth trees to his right. It looked as dark as a cave in there. He looked to his left and saw Henry Bowers lying on his back in the middle of the stream. His half-open eyes showed only whites. Blood trickled from one ear and ran toward Ben in delicate threads. Oh, my God, I killed him. Oh, my God, I'm a murderer. Oh, my God. Forgetting that Belch and Victor were behind him, or perhaps understanding they would lose all interest in beating the shit out of him when they discovered their fearless leader was dead, Ben splashed 20 feet upstream to where Henry lay, his shirt in ribbons, his jeans soaked black, one shoe gone. Ben was vaguely aware that there was precious little left of his own clothes and that his body was one big rattletrap of aches and pains. His left ankle was the worst. It had already puffed tight against his soaking sneaker, and he was favoring it so badly that he was really not walking, but lurching like a sailor on shore for the first time after a long sea voyage. He bent over Henry Bowers. Henry's eyes popped wide open. He grabbed Ben's calf with one scraped and bloody hand. His mouth worked, and although nothing but a series of whistling aspirations emerged, Ben could still make out what he was saying.
Kill you, you fat shit.
Henry was trying to pull himself up, using Ben's leg as a pole. Ben pulled backward frantically. Henry's hand slipped down, then off. Ben flew backward, whirling his arms, and fell on his ass for a record-breaking third time in the last 4 minutes. He also bit his tongue again. Water splashed up around him. A rainbow glimmered for an instant in front of Ben's eyes. Ben didn't give a fuck about the rainbow. He didn't give a fuck about finding a pot of gold. He would settle for his miserable fat life. Henry rolled over, tried to stand, fell back, managed to get to his hands and knees, and finally tottered to his feet. He stared at Ben with those black eyes. The front of his flat top now leaned this way and that, like corn husks after a high wind has passed through. Ben was suddenly angry. No, this was more than being angry. He was infuriated. He had been walking with his library books under his arm, having an innocent little daydream about kissing Beverly Marsh, bothering nobody. And look at this. Just look. Pants shredded, left ankle maybe broken, badly sprained for sure. Leg all cut up, tongue all cut up, Henry Goddamn Bowers' monogram on his stomach. How about all that, happy, crappy sports fans? But it was probably the thought of his library books, for which he was liable, that drove him to charge Henry Bowers. His lost library books and his mental image of how reproachful Mrs. Sterrett's eyes would become when he told her. Whatever the reason, cuts, sprain, library books, or even the thought of the soggy and probably illegible rank card in his back pocket, it was enough to get him moving. He lumbered forward, squashy keds spatting in the shallow water, and kicked Henry squarely in the balls. Henry uttered a horrid rusty scream that sent birds beating up from the trees. He stood spraddle-legged for a moment, hands clasping his crotch, staring unbelievingly at Ben.
Ugh!
He said in a small voice.
Right,
Ben said.
Ugh,
Henry said, in an even smaller voice.
Right,
Ben said again. Henry sank slowly back to his knees, not so much falling as folding up. He was still looking at Ben with those unbelieving black eyes.
Ugh,
damn right, Ben said. Henry fell on his side, still clutching his testicles, and began to roll slowly from side to side.
Ugh, Henry moaned. My balls, ugh. Oh, you broke my balls, ugh, ugh.
He was now beginning to gain a little force, and Ben started to back away a step at a time. He was sickened by what he had done, but he was also filled with a kind of righteous, paralyzed fascination.
Ugh, my fucking sack, ugh, ugh. Oh, my fucking balls.
Ben might have remained in the area for an untold length of time, perhaps even until Henry recovered enough to come after him. But just then a rock struck him above the right ear with such a deep drilling pain that, until he felt warm blood flowing again, Ben thought he had been stung by a wasp. He turned and saw the other two striding up the middle of the stream toward him. They each had a handful of water-rounded rocks. Victor pegged one, and Ben heard it whistle past his ear. He ducked, and another struck his right knee, making him yell with surprised hurt. A third bounced off his right cheekbone, and that eye filled with water. He scrambled for the far bank and climbed it as fast as he could, grabbing onto protruding roots and hauling on handfuls of bushes. He made it to the top. One final stone struck his buttocks as he pulled himself up, and took a quick look back over his shoulder. Belch was kneeling beside Henry while Victor stood half a dozen feet away, firing stones. One the size of a baseball clipped through the man-high bushes beside Ben. He had seen enough. In fact, he had seen much more than enough. Worst of all, Henry Bowers was getting up again. Like Ben's own Timex watch, Henry could take a licking and keep on ticking. Ben turned and smashed his way into the bushes, lumbering along in a direction he hoped was west. If he could cross to the old Cape side of the Barrens, he could beg a dime off somebody and take the bus home. And when he got there, he would lock the door behind him and bury these tattered, bloody clothes in the trash, and this crazy dream would finally be over. Ben thought of himself sitting in his chair in the living room, freshly tubbed, wearing his fuzzy red bathrobe, watching Daffy Duck cartoons on The Mighty 90, and drinking milk through a strawberry flavor straw. Hold that thought, he told himself grimly, and kept lumbering along. Bushes sprang into his face. Ben pushed them aside. Thorns reached and clawed. He tried to ignore them. He came to a flat area of ground that was black and mucky. A thick stand of bamboo-like growth spread across it, and a fetid smell rose from the earth. An ominous thought, quicksand, slipped across the foreground of his mind like a shadow as he looked at the sheen of standing water deeper into the grove of bamboo stuff. He didn't want to go in there. Even if it wasn't quicksand, the mud would suck his sneakers off. He turned right instead, running along the front of the bamboo grove, and finally into a patch of real woods. The trees, mostly firs, were thick, growing everywhere, battling each other for a little space and sun. But there was less undergrowth, and he could move faster. He was no longer sure what direction he was moving in, but still thought he was, on measure, a little ahead of the game. The barrens were enclosed by derry on three sides and bounded by the half-finished turnpike extension on the fourth. Sooner or later he would come out somewhere. His stomach throbbed painfully, and he pulled up the remains of his sweatshirt for a look. He winced and drew a whistle of air in over his teeth. His belly looked like a grotesque Christmas tree ball, all caked red blood and smeared green from his slide down the embankment. He pulled the sweatshirt down again. Looking at that mess made him feel like blowing lunch. Now he heard a low humming noise from ahead. It was one steady note just above the low range of his hearing. An adult, intent only on getting the hell out of there. The mosquitoes had found Ben now, and while nowhere near as big as sparrows, they were pretty big. Would have ignored it, or simply not heard it at all. But Ben was a boy, and he was already getting over his fright. He swerved to his left and pushed through some low laurel bushes. Beyond them, sticking out of the ground, were the top 3 feet of a cement cylinder about 4 feet wide. It was capped with a vented iron manhole cover. The cover was stamped with the words, Derry Sewer Department. The sound, this close it was more a drone than a hum, was coming from some place deep inside. Ben put one eye to a vent hole but could see nothing. He could hear that drone and water running down there someplace, but that was all. He took a breath, got a whiff of a sour smell that was both dank and shitty, and drew back with a wince. It was a sewer, that was all. Or maybe a combined sewer and drainage tunnel. There were plenty of those in flood-conscious Derry. No big deal. But it had given him a funny sort of chill. Part of it was seeing the handiwork of a man in all this overgrown jumble of wilderness, but he supposed part of it was the shape of the thing itself, that concrete cylinder jutting out of the ground. Ben had read H.G. Wells' The Time Machine the year before, first the Classics Comics version and then the whole book. This cylinder with its vented iron cap reminded him of the wells which led down into the country of the slumped and horrible Morlocks. He moved away from it quickly, trying to find west again. He got to a little clearing and turned until his shadow was as directly behind him as he could get it. Then he headed off in a straight line. 5 minutes later, he heard more running water ahead and voices. Kids' voices. He stopped to listen, and that was when he heard snapping branches and other voices behind him. They were perfectly recognizable. They belonged to Victor, Belch, and the one and only Henry Bowers. The nightmare was not over yet, it seemed. Ben looked around for a place to go to Earth. 10. He came out of his hiding place about 2 hours later, dirtier than ever, but a little refreshed. Incredible as it seemed to him, he had dozed off. When he had heard the three of them behind him, coming after him still, Ben had come dangerously close to freezing up completely, like an animal caught in the headlamps of an oncoming truck. A paralytic drowsiness began to steal over him. The idea of simply lying down, curling up into a ball like a hedgehog, and letting them do whatever they felt they had to occurred to him. It was a crazy idea, but it also seemed like a strangely good idea. But instead, Ben began to move toward the sound of the running water and those other kids. He tried to untangle their voices and get the sense of what they were saying, anything to shake off that scary paralysis of the spirit. Some project. They were talking about some project. One or two of the voices were even a little familiar. There was a splash, followed by a burst of good-natured laughter. The laughter filled Ben with a kind of stupid longing and made him more aware of his dangerous position than anything else had done. If he was going to be caught, there was no need to let these kids in for a dose of his medicine. Ben turned right again. Like many large people, he was remarkably light-footed. He passed close enough to the boys to see their shadows moving back and forth between him and the bright water, but they neither saw him nor heard him. Gradually, their voices began to fall behind. He came to a narrow path which had been beaten down to the bare earth. Ben considered it for a moment, then shook his head a little. He crossed it and plunged into the undergrowth again. He moved more slowly now, pushing bushes aside rather than stampeding through them. He was still moving roughly parallel to the stream the other kids had been playing beside. Even through the intervening bushes and trees, he could see it was much wider than the one into which he and Henry had fallen. Here was another of those concrete cylinders, barely visible amid a snarl of blackberry creepers, humming quietly to itself. Beyond, an embankment dropped off to the stream, and here an old, gnarled elm tree leaned crookedly out over the water. Its roots, half exposed by bank erosion, looked like a snarl of dirty hair. Hoping there wouldn't be bugs or snakes, but too tired and numbly frightened to really care, Ben had worked his way between the roots and into a shallow cave beneath. He leaned back. A root jabbed him like an angry finger. He shifted his position a little, and it supported him quite nicely. Here came Henry, Belch, and Victor. He had thought they might be fooled into following the path, but no such luck. They stood close by him for a moment. Any closer, and he could have reached out of his hiding place and touched them. "Bet them little snot holes back there saw him," Belch said. "Well, let's go find out," Henry replied, and they headed back the way they had come. A few moments later, Ben heard him roar, "What the fuck you kids doing here?" There was some sort of reply, but Ben couldn't tell what it was. The kids were too far away, and this close, the river, it was the Kanduskeag, of course, was too loud. But he thought the kids sounded scared. Ben could sympathize. Then Victor Chris bellowed something Ben hadn't understood at all.
"What a fucking baby dam!"
"Baby dam?
B- baby, damn. Or maybe Victor had said, what a damn bunch of babies, and Ben had misheard him. Let's break it, Belch proposed. There were yells of protest followed by a scream of pain. Someone began to cry. Yes, Ben could sympathize. They hadn't been able to catch him, or at least not yet. But here was another bunch of little kids for them to take out their mad on. Sure, break it, Henry said. Splashes, yells, big moronic gusts of laughter from Belch and Victor. An agonized, infuriated cry from one of the little kids. Don't give me any of your shit, you stuttering little freak, Henry Bowers said. I ain't taking no more shit from nobody today. There was a splintering crack. The sound of running water downstream grew louder and roared briefly before quieting to its former placid chuckle. Ben suddenly understood. Baby Dam, yes, that was what Victor had said. The kids, two or three of them it had sounded like when he passed by, had been building a dam. Henry and his friends had just kicked it apart. Ben even thought he knew who one of the kids was. The only stuttering little freak he knew from Derry School was Bill Denbro, who was in the other fifth-grade classroom. You didn't have to do that, a thin and fearful voice cried out, and Ben recognized that voice as well, although he could not immediately put a face with it. Why did you do that? Because I felt like it, fucknuts, Henry roared back. There was a meaty thud. It was followed by a scream of pain. The scream was followed by weeping. Shut up, Victor said. Shut up that crying kid, or I'll pull your ears down and tie them under your chin. The crying became a series of choked snuffles. We're going, Henry said, but before we do, I want to know one thing. You seen a fat kid in the last 10 minutes or so? Big fat kid all bloody and cut up? There was a reply too brief to be anything but no. You sure? Belch asked. You better be mushmouth. I'm sure, Bill Denbro replied. Let's go, Henry said. He probably waded across back that way. Ta-ta, boys, Victor Chris called. It was a real baby dam, believe me. You're better off without it. Splashing sounds. Belch's voice came again, but further away now. Ben couldn't make out the words. In fact, he didn't want to make out the words. Closer by, the boy who had been crying now resumed. There were comforting noises from the other boy. Ben had decided there was just the two of them, stuttering Bill and the weeper. He half sat, half lay where he was, listening to the two boys by the river and the fading sounds of Henry and his dinosaur friends crashing toward the far side of the barrens. Sunlight flicked at his eyes and made little coins of light on the tangled roots above and around him. It was dirty in here, but it was also cozy, safe. The sound of running water was soothing. Even the sound of the crying kid was sort of soothing. His aches and pains had faded to a dull throb, and the sound of the dinosaurs had faded out completely. He would wait a while, just to be sure they weren't coming back, and then he would make tracks. Ben could hear the throb of the drainage machinery coming through the earth, could even feel it. A low, steady vibration that went from the ground to the root he was leaning against and then into his back. He thought of the Morlocks again, of their naked flesh. He imagined it would smell like the dank and shitty air that had come up through the vent holes of that iron cap. He thought of their wells driven deep into the earth, wells with rusty ladders bolted to their sides. He dozed, and at some point his thoughts became a dream. 11. It wasn't Morlocks he dreamed of. He dreamed of the thing which had happened to him in January, the thing which he hadn't quite been able to tell his mother. It had been the first day of school after the long Christmas break. Mrs. Douglas had asked for a volunteer to stay after and help her count the books that had been turned in just before the vacation. Ben had raised his hand. Thank you, Ben, Mrs. Douglas had said, favoring him with a smile of such brilliance that it warmed him down to his toes. Suck-ass, Henry Bowers remarked under his breath. It had been the sort of Maine winter day that is both the best and the worst. Cloudless, eye-wateringly bright, but so cold it was a little frightening. To make the 10-degree temperature worse, there was a strong wind to give the cold a bitter cutting edge. Ben counted books and called out numbers. Mrs. Douglas wrote them down.
not bothering to double-check his work even on a random basis, he was proud to note. And then they both carried the books down to the storage room through the halls where radiators clanked dreamily. At first the school had been full of sounds, slamming locker doors, the clackety-clack of Mrs. Thomas's typewriter in the office, the slightly off-key choral renditions of the glee club upstairs, the nervous thud-thud-thud of basketballs from the gym, and the scrooch and thud of sneakers as players drove toward the baskets or cut turns on the polished wood floor. Little by little these sounds ceased, until, as the last set of books was totted up, one short, but it hardly mattered, Mrs. Douglas sighed, they were all holding together on a wing and a prayer. The only sounds were the radiators, the faint whish-whish of Mr. Fazio's broom as he pushed colored sawdust up the hall floor, and the howl of the wind outside. Ben looked toward the book room's one narrow window and saw that the light was fading rapidly from the sky. It was 4 o'clock and dusk was at hand. Membranes of dry snow blew around the icy jungle gym and skirled between the teeter-totters, which were frozen solidly into the ground. Only the thaws of April would break those bitter winter welds. He saw no one at all on Jackson Street. He looked a moment longer, expecting a car to roll through the Jackson-Witcham intersection, but none did. Everyone in Derry save himself and Mrs. Douglas might be dead or fled, at least from what he could see from here. He looked toward her and saw, with a touch of real fright, that she was feeling almost exactly the same things he was feeling himself. He could tell by the look in her eyes. They were deep and thoughtful and far off, not the eyes of a schoolteacher in her 40s, but those of a child. Her hands were folded just below her breasts, as if in prayer. I'm scared, Ben thought, and she's scared too. But what are we really scared of? He didn't know. Then she looked at him and uttered a short, almost embarrassed laugh. I've kept you too late, she said. I'm sorry, Ben. That's okay. He looked down at his shoes. He loved her a little, not with the frank, unquestioning love he had lavished on Mrs. Thibodeau, his first grade teacher, but he did love her. If I drove, I'd give you a ride, she said, but I don't. My husband's going to pick me up around 5:15. If you'd care to wait, we could... No thanks, Ben said. I ought to get home before then. This was not really the truth, but he felt a queer aversion to the idea of meeting Mrs. Douglas's husband. Maybe your mother could. She doesn't drive either, Ben said. I'll be all right. It's only a mile home. A mile's not far when it's nice, but it can be a very long way in this weather. You'll go in somewhere if it gets too cold, won't you, Ben? Oh, sure. I'll go into Costello's Market and stand by the stove a little while, or something. Mr. Gaudreau doesn't mind. And I got my snow pants, my new Christmas scarf, too. Mrs. Douglas looked a little reassured, and then she glanced toward the window again. It just looks so cold out there, she said. So inimical. He didn't know the word, but he knew exactly what she meant. Something just happened. What? He had seen her, he realized suddenly, as a person instead of just a teacher. That was what had happened. Suddenly he had seen her face in an entirely different way, and because he did, it became a new face. The face of a tired poet. He could see her going home with her husband, sitting beside him in the car with her hands folded as the heater hissed and he talked about his day. He could see her making them dinner. An odd thought crossed his mind, and a cocktail party question rose to his lips. Do you have children, Mrs. Douglas? I often think at this time of the year that people really weren't meant to live this far north of the equator, she said. At least not in this latitude. Then she smiled, and some of the strangeness either went out of her face or his eye. He was able to see her, at least partially, as he always had. But you'll never see her that way again, not completely, he thought, dismayed. I'll feel old until spring, and then I'll feel young again. It's that way every year. Are you sure you'll be all right, Ben? I'll be fine. Yes, I suppose you will. You're a good boy, Ben. He looked back at his toes, blushing, loving her more than ever. In the hallway, Mr. Fazio said, Be careful of defrostbite, boy, without looking up from his red sawdust. I will. He reached his locker, opened it, and yanked on his snow pants. He had been painfully unhappy when his mother insisted he wear them again this winter on especially cold days, thinking of them as baby clothes, but he was glad to have them this afternoon. He walked slowly toward the door, zipping his coat, yanking the drawstrings of his hood tight, pulling on his mittens. He went out and stood on the snow-packed top step of the front stairs for a moment, listening as the door snicked closed and locked behind him. Derry School brooded under a bruised skin of a sky. The wind blew steadily. The snap hooks on the flagpole rope rattled a lonesome tattoo against the steel pole itself. That wind cut into the warm and unprepared flesh of Ben's face at once, numbing his cheeks. "Be careful of the frostbite, boy." He quickly pulled his scarf up until he looked like a small, pudgy caricature of Red Ryder. That darkening sky had a fantastical sort of beauty, but Ben did not pause to admire it. It was too cold for that. He got going. At first the wind was at his back, and things didn't seem so bad. In fact, it actually seemed to be helping him along. At Canal Street, however, he had to turn right and almost fully into the wind. Now it seemed to be holding him back, as if it had business with him. His scarf helped a little, but not enough. His eyes throbbed, and the moisture in his nose froze to a cracked glaze. His legs were going numb. Several times he stuck his mittened hands into his armpits to warm them up. The wind whooped and screamed, sometimes sounding almost human. Ben felt both frightened and exhilarated. Frightened because he could now understand stories he had read, such as Jack London's To Build a Fire, where people actually froze to death. It would be all too possible to freeze to death on a night like this, a night when the temperature would drop to 15 below. The exhilaration was hard to explain. It was a lonely feeling, a somehow melancholy feeling. He was outside. He passed on the wings of the wind, and none of the people beyond the brightly lighted squares of their windows saw him. They were inside, inside, where there was light and warmth. They didn't know he had passed them. Only he knew. It was a secret thing. The moving air burned like needles, but it was fresh and clean. White smoke jetted from his nose in neat little streams. And as sundown came, the last of the day, a cold, yellowy-orange line on the western horizon, the first stars, cruel diamond chips glimmering in the sky overhead, he came to the canal. He was only 3 blocks from home now, and eager to feel the heat on his face and legs, moving the blood again, making it tingle. Still, he paused. The canal was frozen in its concrete sluice like a frozen river of rose milk, its surface humped and cracked and cloudy. It was moveless, yet completely alive in this harshly puritanical winter light. It had its own unique and difficult beauty. Ben turned the other way, southwest, toward the barrens. When he looked in this direction, the wind was at his back again. It made his snow pants ripple and flap. The canal ran straight between its concrete walls for perhaps half a mile. Then the concrete was gone and the river sprawled its way into the barrens, at this time of the year a skeletal world of icy brambles and jutting naked branches. A figure was standing on the ice down there. Ben stared at it and thought, "There may be a man down there, but can he be wearing what it looks like he's wearing? It's impossible, isn't it?" The figure was dressed in what appeared to be a white-silver clown suit. It rippled around him in the polar wind. There were oversized orange shoes on his feet. They matched the pom-pom buttons which ran down the front of his suit. One hand grasped a bundle of strings which rose to a bright bunch of balloons, and when Ben observed that the balloons were floating in his direction, he felt unreality wash over him more strongly. He closed his eyes, rubbed them, opened them. The balloon still appeared to be floating toward him. He heard Mr. Fazio's voice in his head. "Be careful of the frostbite, boy." It had to be a hallucination or a mirage brought on by some weird trick of the weather. There could be a man down there on the ice. He supposed it was even technically possible he could be wearing a clown suit. But the balloons couldn't be floating toward Ben, into the wind. Yet that was just what they appeared to be doing.
"Ben,"
the clown on the ice called. Ben thought that voice was only in his mind, although it seemed he heard it with his ears.
Want a balloon, Ben?
There was something so evil in that voice, so awful, that Ben wanted to run away as fast as he could, but his feet seemed as welded to this sidewalk as the teeter-totters in the schoolyard were welded to the ground.
They float, Ben. They all float. Try one and see.
The clown began walking along the ice toward the canal bridge where Ben stood. Ben watched him come, not moving. He watched as a bird watches an approaching snake. The balloon should have burst in the intense cold, but they did not. They floated above and ahead of the clown when they should have been streaming out behind him, trying to escape back into the barrens, where some part of Ben's mind assured him this creature had come from in the first place. Now Ben noticed something else. Although the last of the daylight had struck a rosy glow across the ice of the canal, the clown cast no shadow, none at all.
You like it here, Ben,
the clown said. Now it was close enough so Ben could hear the clud-clud sound its funny shoes made as they advanced over the uneven ice.
You'll like it here, I promise. All the boys and girls I meet like it here, because it's like Pleasure Island in Pinocchio and Never Never Land in Peter Pan. They never have to grow up, and that's what all the kiddies want. So come on, see the sights, have a balloon, feed the elephants, ride the shoot the shoots. Oh, you'll like it. And, oh, Ben, how you'll float.
And in spite of his fear, Ben found that part of him did want a balloon. Who in all the world owned a balloon which would float into the wind? Who had even heard of such a thing? Yes, he wanted a balloon, and he wanted to see the clown's face, which was bent down toward the ice, as if to keep it out of that killer wind. What might have happened if the 5 o'clock whistle atop the Derry Town Hall hadn't blown just then, Ben didn't know. Didn't want to know. The important thing was that it did blow, an ice pick of sound drilling into the deep winter cold. The clown looked up as if startled, and Ben saw its face.
The mummy! Oh my God, it's the mummy! Was his first thought,
accompanied by a swoony horror that caused him to clamp his hands down viciously on the bridge's railing to keep from fainting. Of course it hadn't been the mummy. Couldn't have been the mummy. Oh, there were Egyptian mummies, plenty of them, he knew that. But his first thought had been that it was the mummy, the dusty monster played by Boris Karloff in the old movie he had stayed up late to watch just last month on Shock Theater. No, it wasn't that mummy. Couldn't be. Movie monsters weren't real. Everyone knew that, even little kids. But it wasn't makeup the clown was wearing. Nor was the clown simply swaddled in a bunch of bandages. There were bandages, most of them around its neck and wrists, blowing back in the wind. But Ben could see the clown's face clearly. It was deeply lined, the skin a parchment map of wrinkles, tattered cheeks, arid flesh. The skin of its forehead was split but bloodless. Dead lips grinned back from a maw in which teeth leaned like tombstones. Its gums were pitted and black. Ben could see no eyes, but something glittered far back in the charcoal pits of those puckered sockets, something like the cold jewels in the eyes of Egyptian scarab beetles. And although the wind was the wrong way, it seemed to him that he could smell cinnamon and spice. Rotting cerements treated with weird drugs, sand, blood so old it had dried to flakes, and grains of rust.
We all float down here, the mummy clown croaked.
And Ben realized with fresh horror that somehow it had reached the bridge. It was now just below him, reaching up with a dry and twisted hand from which flaps of skin rustled like pennons, a hand through which bone like yellow ivory showed. One almost fleshless finger caressed the tip of his boot. Ben's paralysis broke. He pounded the rest of the way across the bridge with the 5 o'clock whistle still shrieking in his ears. It only ceased as he reached the far side. It had to be a mirage. Had to be. The clown simply could not have come so far during the whistle's 10 or 15 second blast. But his fear was not a mirage. Neither were the hot tears which spurted from his eyes and froze on his cheeks a second after being shed. He ran, boots thudding on the sidewalk, and behind him he could hear the mummy in the clown suit climbing up from the canal. ancient stony fingernails scraping across iron, old tendons creaking like dry hinges. He could hear the arid whistle of its breath pulling in and pushing out of nostrils as devoid of moisture as the tunnels under the Great Pyramid. He could smell its shroud of sandy spices, and he knew that in a moment its hands, as fleshless as the geometrical constructions he made with his erector set, would descend upon his shoulders. They would turn him around, and he would stare into that wrinkled, smiling face. The dead river of its breath would wash over him. Those black eye sockets with their deep glowing depths would bend over him. The toothless mouth would yawn, and he would have his balloon. Oh, yes, all the balloons he wanted. But when he reached the corner of his own street, sobbing and winded, his heart slamming crazed, leaping beats into his ears, when he at last looked back over his shoulder, the street was empty. The arched bridge with its low concrete sides and its old-fashioned cobblestone paving was also empty. He could not see the canal itself, but he felt that if he could, he would see nothing there either. No, if the mummy had not been a hallucination or a mirage, if it had been real, it would be waiting under the bridge, like the troll in the story of the Three Billy Goats Gruff. Under. Hiding under. Ben hurried home, looking back every few steps until the door was safely shut and locked behind him. He explained to his mother, who was so tired from a particularly hard day at the mill that she had not, in truth, much missed him, that he had been helping Mrs. Douglas count books. Then he sat down to a dinner of noodles and Sunday's leftover turkey. He stuffed three helpings into himself, and the mummy seemed more distant and dreamlike with each helping. It was not real. Those things were never real. They came fully to life only between the commercials of the late-night TV movies or during the Saturday matinees, where if you were lucky, you could get two monsters for a quarter. And if you had an extra quarter, you could buy all the popcorn you could eat. No, they were not real. TV monsters and movie monsters and comic book monsters were not real. Not until you went to bed and couldn't sleep. Not until the last four pieces of candy, wrapped in tissues and kept under your pillow against the evils of the night, were gobbled up. Not until the bed itself turned into a lake of rancid dreams and the wind screamed outside and you were afraid to look at the window because there might be a face there, an ancient grinning face that had not rotted but simply dried like an old leaf, its eyes sunken diamonds pushed deep into dark sockets. Not until you saw one ripped and claw-like hand holding out a bunch of balloons.
See the sights, have a balloon, feed the elephants, ride the shoot the shoots. Ben, oh Ben, how you float.
12. Ben awoke with a gasp, the dream of the mummy still on him, panicked by the close, vibrating dark all around him. He jerked, and the root stopped supporting him and poked him in the back again, as if in exasperation. He saw light and scrambled for it. He crawled out into the afternoon sunlight and the babble of the stream, and everything fell into place again. It was summer, not winter. The mummy had not carried him away to its desert crypt. Ben had simply hidden from the big kids in a sandy hole under a half-uprooted tree. He was in the barrens. Henry and his buddies had gone to town in a small way on a couple of kids playing downstream because they hadn't been able to find Ben and go to town on him in a big way.
Ta-ta, boys. It was a real baby dam, believe me. You're better off without it.
Ben looked glumly down at his ruined clothes. His mother was going to give him 16 different flavors of holy old hell. He had slept just long enough to stiffen up. He slid down the embankment and then began to walk along the stream, wincing at every step. He was a medley of aches and pains. It felt like Spike Jones was playing a fast tune on broken glass inside most of his muscles. There seemed to be dried or drying blood on every inch of exposed skin. The dam-building kids would be gone anyway, he consoled himself. He wasn't sure how long he'd slept, but even if it had only been half an hour, the encounter with Henry and his friends would have convinced Denbrough and his pal that some other place, like Timbuktu maybe, would be better for their health. Ben plugged grimly along, knowing if the big kids came back now, he would not stand a chance of outrunning them. He hardly cared. He rounded an elbow bend in the stream and just stood there for a moment, looking. The dam builders were still there. One of them was indeed Stuttering Bill Dendro. He was kneeling beside the other boy, who was propped against the stream bank in a sitting position. This other kid's head was thrown so far back that his Adam's apple stood out like a triangular plug. There was dried blood around his nose, on his chin, and painted along his neck in a couple of streams. He had something white clasped loosely in one hand. Stuttering Bill looked around sharply and saw Ben standing there. Ben saw with dismay that something was very wrong with the boy propped up on the bank. Dendro was obviously scared to death. He thought miserably, "Won't this day ever end?"
"I wonder if you could help me," Bill Dendro said. "His aspirator is empty. I think he might be..."
His face froze, turned red. He dug at the word, stuttering like a machine gun. Spittle flew from his lips, and it took almost 30 seconds worth of d-d-d-d before Ben realized Dendro was trying to say the other kid might be dying. Chapter 5. Bill Dendro Beats the Devil, 1. 1. Bill Dendro thinks, "I'm damn near space travel's especially comfortable. In fact, for the first hour following the Concorde's takeoff, or perhaps liftoff would be a better way to put it, from Heathrow, he has been coping with a mild case of claustrophobia. The airplane is narrow, unsettlingly so. The meal is just short of exquisite, but the flight attendants who serve it must twist and bend and squat to get the job done. They look like a troop of gymnasts. Watching this strenuous service takes some of the pleasure out of the food for Bill, although his seatmate doesn't seem particularly bothered. The seatmate is another drawback. He's fat and not particularly clean. It may be Ted Lapidus' cologne on top of his skin, but beneath it, Bill detects the unmistakable odors of dirt and sweat. He's not being very particular about his left elbow, either. Every now and then it strikes Bill with a soft thud. His eyes are drawn again and again to the digital readout at the front of the cabin. It shows how fast this British bullet is going. Now, as the Concorde reaches its cruising speed, it tops out at just over Mach 2. Bill takes his pen from his shirt pocket and uses its tip to tap buttons on the computer watch Audra gave him last Christmas. If the machometer is right, and Bill has absolutely no reason to think it is not, then they are busting along at a speed of 18 miles per minute. He is not sure this is anything he really wanted to know. Outside his window, which is as small and thick as the window in one of the old Mercury space capsules, he can see a sky which is not blue, but the twilight purple of dusk, although it is the middle of the day. At the point where the sea and the sky meet, he can see that the horizon line is slightly bowed. "I am sitting here," Bill thinks, "a Bloody Mary in my hand and a dirty fat man's elbow poking into my bicep, observing the curvature of the earth." He smiles a little, thinking that a man who can face something like that shouldn't be afraid of anything. But he is afraid, and not just of flying at 18 miles a minute in this narrow, fragile shell. He can almost feel Derry rushing at him, and that is exactly the right expression for it. 18 miles a minute or not, the sensation of being perfectly still while Derry rushes at him like some big carnivore which has lain in wait for a long time and has finally broken from cover. Derry. Ah, Derry. Shall we write an ode to Derry? The stink of its mills and its rivers, the dignified quiet of its tree-lined streets, the library, the standpipe, Basie Park, Derry Elementary School, the Barons. Lights are going on in his head, big Kleegs. It's like he's been sitting in a darkened theater for 27 years, waiting for something to happen, and now it's finally begun. The set being revealed spot by spot and Kleeg by Kleeg is not, however, some harmless comedy like Arsenic and Old Lace. To Bill Dendro, it looks more like the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. "All those stories I wrote," he thinks with a stupid kind of amusement. "All those novels. Derry is where they all came from. Derry was the wellspring. They came from what happened that summer, and from what happened to George the autumn before. All the interviewers that ever asked me that question, I gave them the wrong answer. The fat man's elbow digs into him again, and he spills some of his drink. Bill almost says something, then thinks better of it. That question, of course, was, where do you get your ideas? It was a question Bill supposed all writers of fiction had to answer, or pretend to answer, at least twice a week. But a fellow like him, who made a living by writing of things which never were and never could be, had to answer it, or pretend to, much more often than that. All writers have a pipeline which goes down into the subconscious, he told them, neglecting to mention that he doubted more as each year passed if there even was such a thing as a subconscious. But the man or woman who writes horror stories has a pipeline that goes further, maybe, into the sub-subconscious, if you like. Elegant answer that, but one he had never really believed. Subconscious? Well, there was something down there, all right, but Bill thought people had made much too big a deal out of a function which was probably the mental equivalent of your eyes watering when dust got in them, or breaking wind an hour or so after a big dinner. The second metaphor was probably the better of the two, but you couldn't very well tell interviewers that, as far as you were concerned, such things as dreams and vague longings and sensations like déjà vu really came down to nothing more than a bunch of mental farts. But they seemed to need something. All those reporters with their notebooks and their little Japanese tape recorders. And Bill wanted to help them as much as he could. He knew that writing was a hard job, a damned hard job. There was no need to make theirs harder by telling them, "My friend, you might as well ask me who cut the cheese and have done with it." He thought now, you always knew they were asking the wrong question even before Mike called. Now you also know what the right question was. Not where do you get your ideas, but why do you get your ideas? There was a pipeline, all right, but it wasn't either the Freudian or Jungian version of the subconscious that it came out of. No interior drain system of the mind, no subterranean cavern full of Morlocks waiting to happen. There was nothing at the other end of that pipe but dairy. Just dairy. And who's that trip-trapping upon my bridge? He sits bolt upright suddenly, and this time it's his elbow that goes wandering. It sinks deeply into his fat seatmate's side for a moment. "Watch yourself, buddy," the fat man says. "Close quarters, you know." "You stop whapping me with yours, and I'll try to stop whapping you with mine." The fat man gives him a sour, incredulous, "What the hell you talking about?" look. Bill simply gazes at him until the fat man looks away, muttering. "Who's there? Who's trip-trapping over my bridge?" He looks out the window again and thinks, "We're beating the devil." His arms and the nape of his neck prickle. He knocks back the rest of his drink in one swallow. Another of those big lights has gone on. Silver, his bike. That was what he had called it, after the Lone Ranger's horse. A big Schwinn, 28 inches tall. "You'll kill yourself on that, Billy," his father had said, but with no real concern in his tone. He had shown little concern for anything since George's death. Before, he had been tough, fair but tough. Since, you could get around him. He would make fatherly gestures, go through fatherly motions, but motions and gestures were all they were. It was like he was always listening for George to come back into the house. Bill had seen it in the window of the bike and cycle shop down on Center Street. It leaned gloomily on its kickstand, bigger than the biggest of the others on display. Dull where they were shiny, straight in places where the others were curved, bent in places where the others were straight. Propped on its front tire had been a sign. "Used. Make an offer." What actually happened was that Bill went in and the owner made him an offer, which Bill took. He wouldn't have known how to dicker with the cycle shop owner if his life depended on it. And the price, $24, the man quoted seemed very fair to Bill. Generous, even. He paid for silver with money he had saved up over the last 7 or 8 months. Birthday money, Christmas money, lawn mowing money. He had been noticing the bike in the window ever since Thanksgiving. He paid for it and wheeled it home as soon as the snow began to melt for good. It was funny, because he'd never thought much about owning a bike before last year. The idea seemed to come into his mind all at once. Perhaps on one of those endless days after George died, was murdered. In the beginning, Bill almost did kill himself. The first ride on his new bike ended with Bill dumping it on purpose to keep from running smack into the board fence at the end of Kossuth Lane. He had not been so afraid of running into the fence as he had been of bashing right through it and falling 60 feet into the barrens. He came away from that one with a 5-inch gash running between the wrist and elbow of his left arm. Not even a week later, he had found himself unable to brake soon enough and had shot through the intersection of Witcham and Jackson at perhaps 35 miles an hour, a little kid on a dusty gray mastodon of a bike. Silver was silver only by the most energetic reach of a willing imagination. Playing cards, machine-gunning the spokes of the front and back wheels in a steady roar, and if a car had been coming, he would have been dead meat, just like Georgie. He got control of Silver little by little as the spring advanced. Neither of his parents noticed during that time that he was courting death by bicycle. He thought that, after the first few days, they had ceased to really see his bike at all. To them it was just a relic with chipped paint which leaned against the garage wall on rainy days. Silver was a lot more than some dusty old relic, though. He didn't look like much, but he went like the wind. Bill's friend, his only real friend, was a kid named Eddie Kasprak. And Eddie was good with mechanical things. He had shown Bill how to get Silver in shape, which bolts to tighten and check regularly, where to oil the sprockets, how to tighten the chain, how to put on a bike patch so it would stay if you got a flat. "You ought to paint it," he remembered Eddie saying one day. But Bill didn't want to paint Silver. For reasons he couldn't even explain to himself, he wanted the Schwinn just the way it was. It looked like a real bow-wow, the sort of bike a careless kid regularly left out on his lawn in the rain. A bike that would be all squeaks and shudders and slow friction. It looked like a bow-wow, but it went like the wind. It would beat the devil, he says aloud and laughs. His fat seatmate looks at him sharply. The laugh has that howling quality that gave Audra the creeps earlier. Yes, it looked pretty shoddy, with its old paint and the old-fashioned package carrier mounted above the back wheel and the ancient Oogah horn with his black rubber bulb. That horn was permanently welded to the handlebars with a rusty bolt the size of a baby's fist. Pretty shoddy. But could Silver go? Could he? Christ. And it was a damned good thing he could, because Silver had saved Bill Denbrough's life in the fourth week of June 1958, the week after he met Ben Hanscom for the first time, the week after he and Ben and Eddie built the dam, the week that Ben and Richie Trashmouth Tozier and Beverly Marsh showed up in the barrens after the Saturday matinee. Richie had been riding behind him on Silver's package carrier the day Silver had saved Bill's life. So he supposed Silver had saved Richie's, too. And he remembered the house they had been running from, all right. He remembered that just fine. That damned house on Niebolt Street. He had raced to beat the devil that day. Oh, yeah, for sure. Don't you just know it? Some devil with eyes as shiny as old deadly coins. Some hairy old devil with a mouth full of bloody teeth. But all that had come later. If Silver had saved Richie's life and his own that day, then perhaps he had saved Eddie Kasprak's on the day Bill and Eddie met Ben by the kicked-apart remains of their dam in the barrens. Henry Bowers, who looked a little bit like someone had run him through a disposal, had mashed Eddie's nose and then Eddie's asthma had come on strong and his aspirator turned up empty. So it had been Silver that day, too. Silver to the rescue. Bill Denbrough, who hasn't been on a bicycle in almost 17 years, looks out the window of an airplane that would not have been credited, or even imagined, outside of a science fiction magazine in the year 1958. Hi-oh, Silver, away, he thinks, and has to close his eyes against the sudden needling sting of tears. What happened to Silver? He can't remember. That part of the set is still dark. That Klieg has yet to be turned on. Perhaps that is just as well. Perhaps that is a mercy. Hi-yo. Hi-yo, Silver. Hi-yo, Silver. 2. Away, he shouted. The wind tore the words back over his shoulder like a fluttering crepe streamer. They came out big and strong, those words, in a triumphant roar. They were the only ones that ever did. He pedaled down Kansas Street toward town, gaining speed slowly at first. Silver rolled once he got going, but getting going was a job and a half. Watching the gray bike pick up speed was a little like watching a big plane roll down the runway. At first you couldn't believe such a huge waddling gadget could ever actually leave the earth. The idea was absurd. But then you could see its shadow beneath it, and before you even had time to wonder if it was a mirage, the shadow was trailing out long behind it, and the plane was up, cutting its way through the air, as sleek and graceful as a dream in a satisfied mind. Silver was like that. Bill got a little downhill stretch and began to pedal faster, his legs pumping up and down as he stood forward over the bike's fork. He had learned very quickly, after being bashed a couple of times by that fork in the worst place a boy can be bashed, to yank his underpants up as high as he could before mounting Silver. Later that summer, observing this process, Richie would say, "Bill does that because he thinks he might like to have some kids that live someday. It seems like a bad idea to me, but hey, they might always take after his wife, right?" He and Eddie had lowered the seat as far as it would go, and it now bumped and scraped against the small of his back as he worked the pedals. A woman digging weeds in her flower garden shaded her eyes to watch him pass. She smiled a little. The boy in the huge bike reminded her of a monkey she had once seen riding a unicycle in the Barnum and Bailey Circus. "He's apt to kill himself, though," she thought, turning back to her garden. "That bike is too big for him." It was none of her problem, though. 3. Bill had had more sense than to argue with the big boys when they broke out of the bushes, looking like ill-tempered hunters on the track of a beast which had already mauled one of them. Eddie, however, had rashly opened his mouth and Henry Bowers had unloaded on him. Bill knew who they were, all right. Henry, Belch, and Victor were just about the worst kids in Derry School. They had beaten up on Richie Tozier, who Bill sometimes chummed with, a couple of times. The way Bill looked at it, this was partly Richie's own fault. He was not known as Trash Mouth for nothing. One day in April, Richie had said something about their collars as the three of them passed by in the schoolyard. The collars had all been turned up, just like Vic Morrow's and the Blackboard Jungle. Bill, who had been sitting against the building nearby and listlessly shooting a few marbles, hadn't really caught all of it. Neither did Henry and his friends, but they heard enough to turn in Richie's direction. Bill supposed Richie had meant to say whatever he said in a low voice. The trouble was, Richie didn't really have a low voice. "What did you say, you little four-eyes geek?" Victor Chris inquired. "I didn't say nothing," Richie said, and that disclaimer, along with his face, which looked quite sensibly dismayed and scared, might have ended it. Except that Richie's mouth was like a half-tamed horse that has a way of bolting for absolutely no reason at all. Now it suddenly added, "You ought to dig the wax out of your ears, big fella. Want some blasting powder?" They stood looking at him incredulously for a moment, and then they took after him. Stuttering Bill had watched the unequal race from its start to its preordained conclusion from his place against the side of the building. No sense getting involved. Those three galoots would be just as happy to beat up on two kids for the price of one. Richie ran diagonally across the little kid's play yard, leaping over the teeter-totters and dodging among the swings, realizing he had run into a blind alley only when he struck the chain-link fence between the play yard and the park which abutted the school grounds. So he tried to go up the chain-link, all clutching fingers and pointing, seeking sneaker toes, and he was maybe two-thirds of the way to the top when Henry and Victor Chris hauled him back down again, Henry getting him by the back of the jacket and Victor grabbing the seat of his jeans. Richie was screaming when they peeled him off the fence. He hit the asphalt on his back. His glasses flew off. He reached for them and Belch Huggins kicked them away, and that was why one of the bows was mended with adhesive tape this summer. Bill had winced and walked around to the front of the building. He had observed Mrs. Moran, one of the fourth grade teachers, already hurrying over to break things up. But he knew they would get Richie hard before then. And by the time she actually arrived, Richie would be crying.
Ball baby, look at the baby ball.
Bill had only minor problems with them. They made fun of his stutter, of course. An occasional random cruelty came with the jibes. One rainy day, as they were going to lunch in the gym, Belch Huggins had knocked Bill's lunch bag out of his hand and had stomped it flat with one engineer boot, squishing everything inside.
"Oh, ja-ja-gee!"
Belch cried in mock horror, raising his hands and fluttering them about his face.
"Sorry about your little lunch, fa-ha-ha-huck face."
And he had strolled off down the hall toward where Victor Chris was leaning against the drinking fountain outside the boys' room door, just about laughing himself into a hernia. That hadn't been so bad, though. Bill had cadged half a PB&J off Eddie Kasprak, and Richie was happy to give him his deviled egg, one of which his mother packed in his lunch about every second day and which made him want to puke, he claimed.
But you had to stay out of their way. And if you couldn't do that, you had to try and be invisible.
Eddie forgot the rules, so they creamed him. He hadn't been too bad until the big boys went downstream and splashed across to the other side, even though his nose was bleeding like a fountain. When Eddie's snot rag was soaked through, Bill had given him his own and made him put a hand on the nape of his neck and lean his head back. Bill could remember his mother getting Georgie to do that, because Georgie sometimes got nosebleeds. Oh, but it hurt to think about George. It wasn't until the sound of the big boy's buffalo-like progress through the barrens had died away completely, and Eddie's nosebleed had actually stopped, that his asthma got bad. He started heaving for air, his hands opening and then snapping shut like weak traps, his respiration a fluting whistle in his throat.
"Shit!" Eddie gasped. "Asthma! Cripes!"
He scrambled for his aspirator and finally got it out of his pocket. It looked almost like a bottle of Windex, the kind with the sprayer attachment on top. He jammed it into his mouth and punched the trigger.
"Better?"
Bill said anxiously.
"No, it's empty."
Eddie looked at Bill with panicked eyes that said, "I'm caught, Bill, I'm caught." The empty aspirator rolled away from his hand. The stream chuckled on, not caring in the least that Eddie Kasprak could barely breathe. Bill thought randomly that the big boys had been right about one thing. It had been a real baby dam. But they had been having fun, damn it, and he felt a sudden dull fury that it should have to come to this.
"Take it easy, Eddie," he said.
For the next 40 minutes or so, Bill sat next to him. His expectation that Eddie's asthma attack would at any moment let up, gradually fading into unease. By the time Ben Hanscom appeared, the unease had become real fear. It not only wasn't letting up, it was getting worse. And the Center Street Drug, where Eddie got his refills, was 3 miles away, almost. What if he went to get Eddie's stuff and came back to find Eddie unconscious? Unconscious or... Don't shit, please don't think that. Or even dead, his mind insisted implacably.
Like Georgie, dead like Georgie. Don't be such an asshole, he's not going to die.
No, probably not. But what if he came back and found Eddie in a coma? Bill knew all about comas. He had even deduced they were named after those great big waves guys surfed on in Hawaii. And that seemed right enough. After all, what was a coma but a wave that drowned your brain? On doctor shows like Ben Casey, people were always going into comas, and sometimes they stayed there in spite of all Ben Casey's ill-tempered shouting. So he sat there, knowing he ought to go. He couldn't do Eddie any good staying here, but not wanting to leave him alone. An irrational, superstitious part of him felt sure Eddie would slip into a coma the minute he, Bill, turned his back. Then he looked upstream and saw Ben Hanscom standing there. He knew who Ben was, of course. The fattest kid in any school has his or her own sort of unhappy notoriety. Ben was in the other fifth grade. Bill sometimes saw him at recess, standing by himself, usually in a corner, looking at a book and eating his lunch out of a bag about the size of a laundry sack. Looking at Ben now, Bill thought he looked even worse than Henry Bowers. It was hard to believe, but true. Bill could not begin to imagine the cataclysmic fight these two must have been in. Ben's hair stood up in wild, dirt-clotted spikes. His sweater, or sweatshirt, it was hard to tell which it had started the day as, and it sure as shit didn't matter now, was a matted ruin, smeared with a sicko mixture of blood and grass. His pants were out at the knees. He saw Bill looking at him and recoiled a bit, eyes going wary.
"D-d-d-hunk-g-g-go,"
Bill cried. He put his empty hands up in the air, palms out, to show he was harmless.
We need some help.
Ben came closer, eyes still wary. He walked as if one or both of his legs was killing him.
"Are they gone? Bowers and those guys?"
Yes,
Bill said.
"Listen, Cahen, you stay with my friend while I go get his medicine? He's got asthma?
Bill nodded. Ben came all the way down to the remains of the dam and dropped painfully to one knee beside Eddie, who was lying back with his eyes mostly closed and his chest heaving.
"Which one hit him?"
Ben asked finally. He looked up, and Bill saw the same frustrated anger he had been feeling himself on the fat kid's face.
"Was it Henry Bowers?"
Bill nodded.
"It figures. Sure, go on. I'll stay with him. To the Hanks."
"Oh, don't thank me," Ben said. "I'm the reason they landed on you in the first place. Go on, hurry it up. I have to be home for supper." Bill went without saying anything else. It would have been good to tell Ben not to take it to heart. What had happened hadn't been Ben's fault any more than it had been Eddie's for stupidly opening his mouth. Guys like Henry and his buddies were an accident waiting to happen. The little kid's version of floods or tornadoes or gallstones. It would have been good to say that, but he was so tightly wound right now, it would have taken him about 20 minutes or so. And by then, Eddie might have slipped into a coma. That was another thing Bill had learned from Doctors Casey and Kildare. You never went into a coma. You always slipped into one. He trotted downstream, glancing back once. He saw Ben Hanscom grimly collecting rocks from the edge of the water. For a moment, Bill couldn't figure out what he was doing. And then he understood. It was an ammo dump, just in case they came back. 4. The Barrens were no mystery to Bill. He had played here a lot this spring, sometimes with Richie, more frequently with Eddie, sometimes all by himself. He had by no means explored the whole area, but he could find his way back to Kansas Street from the Kanduskeag with no trouble, and now did. He came out at a wooden bridge where Kansas Street crossed one of the little no-name streams that flowed out of the dairy drainage system and into the Kanduskeag down below. Silver was stashed under this bridge, his handlebars tied to one of the bridge supports with a hank of rope to keep his wheels out of the water. Bill untied the rope, stuck it in his shirt, and hauled Silver up to the sidewalk by main force, panting and sweating, losing his balance a couple of times and landing on his tail. But at last it was up. Bill swung his leg over the high fork, and as always, once he was on Silver, he became someone else.